views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Reclaim your power and learn to live your most amazing life with Mike Murphy Unfiltered Radio. Unfettered, unflinching, unafraid. Tune in every Thursday from noon to 2 Pacific Time on TransformationTalkRadio.com as Mike explores authentic and relevant truth and powerful conversations with some of the world's most renowned game changers. This hit show taps the dynamic principles of the creation frequency to unleash unlimited infinite potential and guide you to manifesting the highest possibilities of your heart. Level up your life and rewire your programming. Think new thoughts and create true freedom. Let's expand energy, build true health and explosive frequency consciousness together. Powerful people, powerful conversations, powerful listeners. Infinite possibilities, fostering peace and joy with an unfiltered heart. Now, here's Mike Murphy, unfiltered.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Mike Murphy Unfiltered Show. And I'm Mike Murphy, and we're so glad that you're joining us today. And I'm so excited. We have a super special guest today. His name is Dale Borglum, and he's been guiding people for over 35 years now on the process of dying and what he calls conscious dying and healing through that experience. And just a fascinating guy. And so I want to tell you what an amazing guy he is. I first met Dale in 2011. And unfortunately at that time, my wife was terminal and the hospice nurse had just given her, you know, a few days to die. And we had a mutual friend that introduced me to Dale. And so when the time was near, I called him up and, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was in grief and shock and sadness and fear and all that stuff. And so I called this man and I said, hey, listen, you know, here's what's going on. My wife's dying. I understand that you work with people that are dying. Can you help us? He said, yeah, tell me what's going on and I'll be there in 4 hours. And this guy drove all the way from Marin to Alamo, which is about a 90-minute drive one way, in a car that was barely running. I mean, running on fumes.
And, exaggeration.
It was a bit of a struggle, but he showed up every day the last week of my wife's life and taught her the process of going through this death and gave us so many practical tools that brought peace and comfort to her. Peace and comfort to me beyond my wildest expectations and to all of our family members. It was just an amazing experience. And he runs a great organization called Living Dying Project out of Marin. He's been doing this for a long time. And you know what, folks? Everybody's going to die at some point. And it's such a sensitive subject when you're not the one dying. How do we react? What do we say? And he's a master at all this. So I'm so excited to have Dale as our guest today. Dale, welcome to the show.
So glad to be here, Mike.
So tell me, Dale, here's what I know. You got your undergrad at Berkeley in the 70s in mathematics. You're over at Stanford trying to get your PhD in mathematics. And next thing you know, you're in India around a guy named Neem Karola Baba. What happened there?
Well, I actually did get my PhD. I didn't just try. I got a PhD in math, and that how can I put it? I'm still recovering. I'm a recovering mathematician. I honestly think that one of the most serious spiritual illnesses is intellectualism and trusting your mind. There's a bumper sticker, don't believe everything you think.
Right.
And of course, mathematicians are really trained to analyze, categorize. So I was fortunate enough that when I was going to Stanford, my neighbor, guy across the street, Joel, a good friend of mine, was a friend of Ram Dass's.
Ram Dass being?
Richard Alpert.
Okay. Richard Alpert at the time, and eventually came Ram Dass and kind of brought the Eastern philosophy back to the West.
Yeah. Well, he was actually Ram Dass at the time I met him.
Okay.
And he and Timothy Leary were the psychedelic Johnny Appleseeds who kind of ruined psychedelics for, in terms of what the government thought about the whole thing. But anyway, I got to be his friend. He would stay at Joel's house whenever he would come to California, Northern California. And I had been a really good mathematician, but I didn't like it. It just felt like I was good at it. I should do this, but I was thinking I'm on the wrong planet here. What's going on? This isn't something that fills me at all. Mm. And eventually, though, I got into yoga and meditation and all those things. And then I met Ram Dass, and he was on the same path, maybe a few years ahead of me, if you will. And eventually I went with him to India, where we met this guy named Karoli Baba Maharaji. I'm not trying to sell a group, but meeting somebody who is the full embodiment of unconditional love is a life-transforming experience. And I came back from India feeling I didn't want to be a scientist anymore. So I became the executive director of Ram Dass's nonprofit foundation, the Hanuman Foundation, that was doing service-oriented projects, people going into prisons, talking to prisoners. And at one point, Ram Dass taught a workshop on the East Coast at which Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came as a workshop participant. And a friend of Ram Dass's, Stephen Levine, was the Buddhist meditation teacher. Elizabeth and Stephen really hit it off. She invited him to be the meditation teacher at her retreats. They did this for a while, and she then started getting involved in kind of violent psychodrama. You need to have a war on negativity before you can die well, which didn't dovetail too well with Stephen's Buddhist meditation. So he and Elizabeth amicably parted ways. He started teaching on his own, and he invited me to be the Buddhist meditation teacher at his retreats. So this Stephen and I and Ram Dass were all really into meditation, spiritual practice. And this was really the beginning of what can be called the conscious dying movement in America. And really all I mean by that is, can we take the traditional wisdom of contemplative traditions of Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, the core teaching of how to wake up, how to be present, how to be a loving, compassionate human being, and bring that to which for almost everybody is the most difficult and challenging experience in a lifetime, which is the encounter with dying. So we were teaching these workshops, going around the country, talking about conscious dying, and eventually decided it would be really great to have a place where we could put these notions into practice. There was actually a home, a facility where people could come and die consciously. Mm. We moved to New Mexico in the beginning of 1980, and Ram Dass, who was really great at initiating things, not the best guy at follow through, he went off and did his own thing, and Stephen fell in love with his wife-to-be, Andrea. And it was left to me. So I started this place called the Dying Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico. In the early 1980s, for 3.5 years, there were 86, 87 people came. In the beginning, everybody that came got better and left. Because we had loving people and great food, and it was free and out in the country. So I was in the bizarre position of hoping somebody would die to validate my career. Kind of saying that, joking.
No, nobody would die for you.
Well, eventually they started cooperating.
Well, let me ask you this, Dale. Of those people, in your experience, what percentage of people are afraid of death?
99.999.
Where does that come from, in your opinion?
So, in my view, all fear is fear of death. The New York Times had a survey. What are you most afraid of? Mm-hmm. Number one was speaking in public. Number three was dying. Mm. But the place in me that would be embarrassed about speaking in public, here I am on the radio. Right. What if I say stupid things? What if I act like an idiot today, which happens sometimes, of course. That place in me that would be potentially be embarrassed is the place I feel separate. where I don't realize there is a oneness. Mm-hmm. So that there's you and me, you're in Southern California, I'm in Northern California, there's radio listeners probably all over the world. There is a level of reality where we are all separate. But is there also a level of reality where we're not? In the dimension where we're separate, you and I are going to die. Everybody's going to die. In fact, we're all going to die, but we don't know when. What could be more obvious intellectually? But if we really knew that we didn't know when we were going to die, how would it affect the way you and I were talking right now? If I've known you for 8 or 9 years now, I expect to see you again, but who knows? I mean, Maybe one of us dies before the end of the radio show. That'd be pretty dramatic. We'd get a big audience then.
Good ratings.
So what I'm saying is that the place where I don't remember that there's part of me that doesn't die, that there's something that is pure consciousness, where I'm caught there, that is going to be fear of death. And that is popping up all over the place. Fear of death is lack of enlightenment. It's the place where I'm caught in separateness. And the way this happens, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been around, I'm sure you have a bunch of kids, around a tiny baby. They're just resting in love. There's no separation. They're in a symbiotic relationship with mother and really with the world itself. Okay. But as this child begins to grow up, she's socialized. And she begins to realize there are rules to follow, not one's impulses. You can't make too much noise. You can't draw on the wall. You can't pee on the living room floor. You've got to pay attention. You've got to know that there's a world out there. So the kind of the dark secret here is I'm not that interested in dying. I'm interested in awakening. I'm interested in waking up. And one of my first meditation teachers said that until one comes in intimate contact with death, one's spiritual practice will have the quality of you just being a dilettante. You've really got to know in your bones that you're going to die. You've watched your wife die, and I know you well enough to know that you've done a lot of work with dying. You've helped people die. And in my humble opinion, you have grown immeasurably through those experiences. So that's why I choose to do that. And in fact, the most beautiful Americans I've ever met, almost without exception, are people who are almost dead because they're willing to be themselves. They're not saying, I'm rich, I'm poor, my nose is too big. You know,
the ego has already died before they left their body, so now they're free.
Well, they're moving in that direction in a very dramatic way.
Right.
Right. So I go to a party and somebody says, what do you do? And I know that at that point, half the people are going to gather around and be fascinated. The other half are going to run out of the room. Right. So
let me ask you this, Dale. You spent most of your adult life working with people going through this dying process.
Yeah.
What happens to us after we die, after we take that last breath?
Well, of course, that's the big question. And strangely enough, I don't care too much. What I'm interested in is how can I live my life knowing that I'm going to die, and how can I support other people who are dying so that in a very practical way, we're as woke, as awakened as possible. Now, the work I do assumes that consciousness survives death, that there's part of you, part of me, part of everybody that is going to die and part that isn't going to die. And we live in a culture that is really preoccupied with the part that does die. So I'm playing the devil's advocate position saying, hey, guys, there's this other part of awareness that doesn't die. So let's do a quick experiment. I'm going to ask you a question. I'd like you to give me the answer to the question. Here's the question. Are you aware?
Yes.
So what happened between the end of the question and the yes?
My mind had to think about it.
But you looked at awareness.
Right.
Could you stay there?
Of course. Not easily, but of course.
awareness watching awareness rather than being fixated on the content all the time. Oh my God, I'm going to die. Oh, my friend is dying. So I'm not saying some Marin woo-woo thing here that we're not going to die. It's all perfect. You know, it's really sad when your wife dies. It's really sad when I've got several clients now who are dying. And a dear friend of mine died just a couple of months ago. I'm not denying the human aspect. But what I'm saying is, can we keep this balance of the human and the divine, the finite and the infinite, the mundane and the sacred? All, I mean, both of those are happening at the same time. And the human is contextualized in the infinite all the time. Can we remember the spiritual context, if you will?
Right. So you bring up an interesting point, and I don't know if this is the friend you're referring to, but in reading your newsletter, you talk about, or one of your volunteers talks about a woman named Travis.
Yeah, that's what I was mentioning.
Okay. And what I love about this, and I'm going to share this with the audience because this really resonates with me, but Travis was a volunteer with the Living Dying Project. So she's sat at the bed of those that are passing. So I think she was greatly evolved through that work, as it's greatly touched me and changed me. You know, I don't think there's anything more sacred than we can do just to be there while someone is dying. I couldn't be there consciously while my wife was dying because I was full of fear and sadness and what have you. But having sat at other people's bedsides since, I realized how powerful that is and what a powerful experience it is. It will forever change you. But here's this amazing woman, Travis, and here's what she wrote. Keep in mind, she was a volunteer, so she sat with many people as they passed on. But being with people as they are dying has always drawn me. And I am actually enjoying the intensity of that work very much. I feel as though dying is a kind of adventure. And aside from leaving my loved ones and family in pain, I'm kind of excited about what my own journey, adventure, experience might be. Though this may be difficult for some to hear, and believe me, my family is tired of hearing me talk about the possible upcoming adventure of my death, it is part of who I am. I hold dying to be one of many complex, intimate, exhilarating parts of the living. And gosh, we're all going to do it. So why not enjoy it? And, you know, honestly, you know, after the passing of my wife and working with you and sitting at people's, and that's my attitude towards death. How does that sit with you?
That I completely agree with Travis. And in fact, let me give a plug here. We have a website, livingdying.org. And on the homepage, there's a very recently produced video, 6 minutes short video. Some of it's me talking about the Living Dying Project, but a lot of it is me going to Travis's house a couple times and talking to her. So there's me talking to Travis, Travis talking to me, mostly her talking. She likes, she was a good talker.
Okay.
Anyway, so if you wanted to have this intimate, be part of this intimate encounter where I'm guiding her. And it was really only a few weeks before she died. It's right there at livingdying.org.
Well, folks, I really encourage you, one, to go watch that video. You know, here's what I've learned about, you know, losing. I promise you, I have total fear of death. Now, do I have fear of pain and through that process or torture and stuff like that? Yes, that's probably the only fear that I have. And I really believe when that moment comes that I can transcend that as well, because I was blessed to watch my amazing 38-year-old wife while she was dying transcend suffering and transcend death. But go to Dale's website, livingdying.org, and watch the video, but then check into being a volunteer, and you know, or check into, there might be other things that you can do there or learn there. And so here's another issue, Dale. And so many times people come to me and say, oh, my cousin's dying, my mom's dying, my aunt's dying, whatever. And so I'll say, well, you know, you got to contact Dale. You got to go to this website. You got to learn about this, and he can help you. And what I find is there's so much resistance from not the person that's dying, they'd probably welcome it, but from their loved ones to even introduce the subject. Why do we have such a difficult time talking about death in this society?
What do you think?
Fear?
So if your wife is dying, in a way, it's a finger pointing at you saying that you're going to die too.
So we're fear of our own mortality when that happens.
Of course we are. And so everybody's going to die. Everybody doesn't know when. But one wise person once said, the most amazing thing in the world is everybody is going to die, but everybody acts as if they were not going to die, if they were immortal.
Right.
So when somebody's dying and you have to admit they're dying, then you have to admit that you're going to die.
Right.
And I don't think for a lot of people, let me even say it another way. In Buddhism, suffering arises. There are three possible responses. One is, I'm going to push it away. I don't want to think about that. Let me get out of here.
Right.
Give an example. My brother died a few years ago of pancreatic cancer on Halloween. Trick or treat. And he was informed of his terminal prognosis by his Kaiser oncologist in an after-hours email.
Jeez.
So the doctor's saying, here's this guy, he's got relatively young kids. I have to give him this really bad news. I'm a really busy guy. I'm just going to send him an email at 7 p.m. when he can't even respond. Okay. So
who's afraid of dying in that situation?
Okay. So it's easy to have compassion for my brother. Can we have compassion for the doctor? Maybe that's a little harder, but maybe he's never been trained to do those things. I'm not.
Right. Exactly.
I'm just using him as an example.
I understand.
Where one of the main ways we deal with fear is to push it away.
Right.
Another way is to get lost in it. Oh my God, you're dying. What can I do? Your suffering is my suffering. This kind of codependent relationship. There is a third possibility, which is compassion. Hmm. To have an open-hearted, aware, intimate relationship with suffering as it arises.
Right.
That takes practice.
Right.
And I could even go back, and you mentioned about our website. There's so much free information of guided meditations and free talks and things like that. But we also have an online workshop. And you invited people to be Living Dying Project volunteers, which is great if you live in the Bay Area.
Right.
But we have adjunct volunteers all around the world, in Italy, in Denmark, in Australia, in Canada, all around the United States. So if somebody wanted to take this training, you could then be an adjunct volunteer anywhere in the world, really, and work with your loved ones or friends or whoever it is that might need this kind of support.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, if this is resonating with you somewhere in your heart, check it out, because I really believe that just learning this process of what Dale teaches, and I think he's the finest teacher in the world today of teaching people how to be there, just be there while someone is passing on. And if you can learn this skill, master this skill, you will be blessed beyond your wildest dreams to just be able to sit there and assist someone as they leave the physical into the non-physical. So I strongly encourage you that. And let me ask you, do you even charge for this service from the volunteers in the Bay Area if they go to someone's house? Is there a charge or anything?
No, it's all free.
Yeah.
So, but let me make another point that even if you don't know somebody who's dying, or even if you don't want to work with dying people, beginning to work with the feelings in yourself, beginning to get in touch with how fear arises and have compassion for your own self. I mean, in a way that's necessary before we can train people to be with somebody else who's dying, that can you be with your own fear? And just as an example, I mean, it's slightly esoteric, but when I was doing a lot of longer meditation retreats, I would go into this really beautiful space. My mind was just spacious and open and no suffering, just everything was wonderful. And then these thoughts would keep coming up of just like trivial stuff. And I kept wondering, why didn't I just stay in that place? So there was this sequence of spaciousness, thought, awareness of thought, back to spaciousness, thought, awareness of thought. But when I really, really paid attention, right before I went from spaciousness into thinking, there was fear of death. Mm. And it's not like my mind said, you're afraid of dying, but that there was this sense of the ego wanted to reify itself. You know, there was not me meditating. I was just space. I was just open. I was just heart. And then the ego says, wait a minute, what about me? Let's think about lunch. Let's think about, you know, whatever it might be like that, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, in a way, getting in touch with that place in yourself, how we keep, we again and again need to keep feeling we're solid, we're real, that So Stephen Levine, my friend Stephen, wrote a book, Who Dies? And it's a very good question to ask. Is there part of, is all of you going to die? I mean, if you, you can be aware of your body, right? You can be aware of your hand, what it feels like. You can be aware of your sitting on a chair. You can be aware of your mind, right? You can be aware the thoughts and emotions are arising. Mm-hmm. Those things must be objects then. Mm-hmm. What's the subject?
Right. Right.
And so the medical model is that the brain is fundamental and mind is secondary, that the mind is a function of the brain. But mystical traditions, modern quantum mechanics, and all kinds of recent books say it's just the opposite, that the mind is fundamental and it's creating reality, and that the brain is secondary to the mind. There's a guy who wrote, Eben Alexander, who wrote that book, Proof of Heaven, where he was in a coma for 3 or 4 days, and he had no brain activity. He was hooked up to these monitors, completely flat brain waves. But during this time, he was having all these experiences of going to heaven and all these different things. Unfortunately, there was a lot of pink clouds in heaven. but the point is that he had mind even when there was no brain. Mm-hmm. So the brain's going to die.
Right.
The body's going to die.
Consciousness will stay.
The consciousness will stay.
Let me ask you this. So Deepak Chopra wrote a book called Life After Death. And it's been a long time since I read it, but my biggest takeaway was that whatever we believe is going to happen when after we die is going to be our actual experience. So, for example, if I'm Christian, I die, I'm going to have a Jesus, heaven, hell experience. And if I'm a Buddhist, I'll have a different experience. And for me, you know, as a teacher of law of attraction and stuff like that, where I believe that with our thoughts and our emotions, we can manifest what we desire into our physical reality, that kind of resonates with me a little bit. What do you think about that philosophy?
Well, I certainly think that if you're not a Tibetan Buddhist, that you're not going to go through the bardos in the way that the Tibetan Book of the Dead explains, and that you're not going to be seeing those Tibetan deities, that one's cultural beliefs will deeply color what happens. But I think that there is a truth, there is a process that happens after death, that when we push away the differences that have to do with culture and geography and things like that, that there is a basic after death experience. And I'm not trying to sell this. You could say, how do I know this? And I can say that I've been around a lot of people who have died, and I've gone deeply into meditation experiences, and people who have taken a lot of psychedelics say this. But the main thing is I've had the great blessing to be around some of the greatest meditation masters of the late 20th century. And everything they said about living has turned out to be true. So I'm assuming that what they said about the after-death state is true. And what they say is that after what happens after death, the first part of that is essentially what happens in the near-death experience, in which we have a great deal of literature that's incredibly consistent. Consciousness leaves the body. It hovers the body. It feels a great deal of wholeness, integrity, and safety. Suppose you've been blind all of your life. During the near-death experience, you can see what color clothes the doctor has on. You can, even there are cases where people died in a hospital room, temporarily died on an operating table or something, and their consciousness was drawn to another place in the hospital where there was a comatose person on another floor who the doctors couldn't figure out what's wrong with that person. So the dead guy was drawn to the comatose guy, and the comatose guy told the dead guy, hey, it's my pancreas or whatever.
Wow.
So then the dead guy comes back to his body on the operating table. He's revived. There's only a near-death experience. And he said, wow, I've had this incredible experience. And by the way, the guy in room 523 is pancreas. So they went up there, and it was the pancreas. So that or somebody has been in a horrible automobile accident, or you know, they're traumatized or they have a lot of opioids in their bloodstream.
Yeah.
During the near-death experience, as consciousness is not in the body, it's not affected by the limitations of the body.
Yeah.
And in fact, even the consciousness is a little confused as to why the EMT people are so much seeing this as a crisis, because they feel completely fine.
Wow. That's amazing. Excuse me one second, because we got to run to a break, Dale.
Okay.
So we're so happy and grateful you're here, folks. Listen, this is an important subject. Like Dale said, we're all going to die. We just don't know when. So share this with your friends. And there's a lot of depth that we can really get when we free ourselves from the fear of this death. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Dale about reincarnation, his opinion on that. Stay with us, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm so excited and grateful we have a special guest with us, Dale Borgum, who spent the majority of his entire adult life working with people as they leave their body and they die. And so he's just an amazing man. He does amazing work, and he's been a great friend to me. And I just want to share some of the practical things that Dale gave us when my wife was dying, so that when your time comes or someone close to you, one of the first things he did is he had everybody in our family come and say goodbye to her the last week of her life. And it was so interesting. It's like one by one, they would come into our home. And so, you know, I would take them into the bedroom and then leave them. And they got to say goodbye to my wife, Margot, as she was passing away, and clear up anything that needed to be cleared up. And it was such a powerful experience for everybody that did it and for me as the witness. And then the other amazing thing that
I
suggest, go ahead, please.
The one thing that happened that I really remember was Margot's niece and nephew, who are really small kids, maybe like 2 and 5 or something that. Their mothers, I said, you know, maybe the kids could come and say goodbye to Margot. They were so close to her, so close to them. And her mother said, I don't know, they might be too young for that. It might be scary. And I said, no, I think it would be really good. So her husband brought the kids over, and we met them out in the front, in the driveway. And your sister-in-law said, we're going to go in there, and Aunt Margot looks like she's asleep. And I said, it looks like she's asleep, but she's dead. But it's okay. This is your chance to say goodbye to her. She's on her way to heaven, and now you can say goodbye.
Yeah.
The kids came into the room with some trepidation, and I let the four of them be there. I left, and 10 or 15 minutes later, I came back in the room, and the kids were playing on the bed. Your niece was putting makeup on Margot on the little 2-year-old boy was playing on the bed. And my feeling is that they won't have the same fear of death.
Exactly.
That a lot of other kids. I mean, when I was a kid, my grandfather died, and just like he disappeared. I mean, nobody even told me what had happened. It's just, he was in my life. And then the next day he was completely gone.
Yeah. Well, and I was referring to, because you had everybody before she had passed on come and say goodbye to her while she was still alive.
Right.
And so that was an opportunity to clear up any loose ends and bring that healing. But then you suggested to me that after she passes, to make her look really pretty and have everybody say goodbye to her now that she's left her body. And like you said, it was amazingly powerful. My oldest daughter, who's greatly a fear of death at the time, said, I'm no longer afraid of death because Margot looks so peaceful. And my two other nieces and nephew, one niece and nephew older than those two little kids, asked their parents to even leave the room so they could say goodbye to her after she'd left her body as well. So I guarantee you those two kids, their fear of death has dissipated. Because it's a natural thing, ladies and gentlemen. We're born, we live, we die, and Dale, do we do it all over again? Reincarnation. Does it exist?
Okay. Well, so the Buddha said there are four things that can unhinge the mind. One of them is trying to understand reincarnation. Another is trying to understand karma. Another is how it all began, and the last one is how it will all end. So the Buddhists have a kind of a tricky, sneaky way of talking about it, where they can't quite remember either. They believe in rebirth but not reincarnation, or reincarnation not rebirth. It's just the terminology is such that there's not a you who is reborn, but that who you are completely determines this next being. Mm. The way my kind of metaphor is that I'm like a candle. I'm this burning candle, and my flame is this unique flame. It's different from all the other flames, mm-hmm. from your flame and everybody else's flame. And that as I die, just as my flame is going to go out, God comes and lights another candle with that flame. That is the quality of that second candle is completely determined by the quality of my flame, but then my flame goes out. So this new candle, is that an incarnation of me, or it's basically just terminology.
Right.
But my sense is that I've got karma. I'm not done, and it's got to get worked out somewhere or another. So I believe in reincarnation in some kind of vague way. But once again, I'm really a practical guy. It's, as I said, I'm a recovering mathematician. So that. I think having these ideas about heaven and hell and reincarnation and stuff can be comforting, but it's kind of dangerous in the fact that you think, I don't have to prepare now because I'm going to go to heaven or, you know, I've been a pretty good guy, but it's really a moment to moment. It's a living project. It's like moment to moment. Can we be awake? Can we be alive and generous and kind?
Yeah.
Which doesn't mean that we're not strong and we protest and we do what we need to do.
Right. Well, so I love the concept of karma because you do good, you get good. You do bad, you get bad. And so for me, that makes it easier for me to live my life because, you know, there's injustice everywhere. And so, but it enables me to let the injustice go and realize that, you know, this is all going to come out in the wash, you know.
Eventually,
right? And the key is to be patient with that, right? But what I find is I can live in a state of more grace and more peace by embracing that concept than just trying to let everything go.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. I really want to know, because you, how many years were you there in India with Maharaji?
Well, in a way, I've never left.
Yeah, okay.
But that first time, I was there for 13 months.
So tell me what that was. What was that guy? So, ladies and gentlemen, his name is Neem Karol Baba. Went by the name Maharaji. And he was just an amazing spiritual teacher, guru. What was it like to be there, study with him for 13 months?
Well, it's probably not what you would expect. I mean, he was not a teacher in the sense that he taught us meditation we just hung out. He fed us. He had to eat a lot. if you started to meditate, he'd pull on your beard to get you out of meditation. It was incredibly informal. There's a wonderful book called Miracle of Love that Ram Dass put together that has hundreds, maybe 1,000 stories about Maharaji in it. And what it was like for me was that I mentioned before that I felt when I was this mathematician that I was kind of on the wrong planet. There was some big mistake had been made. It just seemed like something was wrong. And when I met Maharaji for the first time in my life, it felt like I was home.
Wow.
That, and yet being with him was not easy because, like, if you and I get together for dinner, and we don't completely connect, I can say, well, maybe Mike is, you know, he's worried about his business or he's newly married and that takes a lot of energy or whatever, right? But when I was with Maharaji, if there was any lack of completely loving relationship, I knew it was because I wasn't available.
Yeah.
And I felt like...
Because he was always present?
Not only present, he was pure love. So that I felt like I was dying of thirst. And I come to the source of all this, the most wonderful nectar, and he was giving it to me, but he was pouring it into this cup that had holes in the bottom. It was all like running out the bottom, and that it was challenging and frustrating because there were times when I had this incredible experience of connectedness, but a lot of time I was jealous and I was anxious and I was horny and I was, you know, wanting him to pay attention to me and give me a name. He gave Krishnas a name. Why didn't I get a name right away? Why did I have to wait? You know, something like that.
So after being with him in that presence of that unconditional love and all the other amazing people that were with you, now 30, 40 years, whatever it is later, Is most of that dissipated, those thoughts that you just had, those petty jealousies and stuff?
Well, yeah, they have. At the same time, I would say that I don't really think that much about Maharaji as a person, like remembering the time together. It's more like his form is a vehicle to love to go into formlessness. In other words, that place in you and me that doesn't die, my love for him helps me trust that I can dissolve into that. That place I was saying, how fear arises, the ego wants to reify itself. Well, one of the things that gives us faith that we can dissolve into that space is love, is trust, is some connection with the sacred.
Yeah.
I mean, there's...
Go ahead. Okay, so I want to, because you brought up love, and you wrote this in your recent newsletter. Lasting love is unattainable until we confront our fear of death. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, okay, so Barry Jampolsky wrote a book, Love is Letting Go of Fear. He is the founder of this thing called the Center for Attitudinal Healing, which changed its name, but they offer free support groups for dying kids and for other people. And when I first heard the title of that book, Love is Letting Go of Fear, I thought, boy, is that is that saccharine? Is that corny, you know? Right. And yet, the more I've matured, there's a real truth to that. I mean, I still kind of argue with the title because it sounds like all you've got to do is let go of fear, which is not that easy. But when we were in India, Ramdas had this saying, faith, comma, no fear, fear, comma, no faith. So that in any moment, either I'm resting in love and faith or I'm caught in fear. And it's not just the big fear that I'm going to die, but there's a subtle anxiety that we've gotten used to. There's this background sense of grief or anxiety that people say, oh, that's just the human condition. And then there are these kind of serendipitous, wonderful moments where we pop out of that and we're resting in love. I mean, you fell in love, you got married, you're happy, right? And that initial falling in love, you know, it pops you out of the human condition in a certain way. But then after a while, even though you're in love with your wife, there's still that background thing happening. Mm-hmm. And so being around dying people or being around a guru reminds you that, hey, there's this other way, this other, how alive are you willing to be right now?
Right.
And my first guru, Bob Dylan, said, what price do we have to pay to get out of going through all these things twice? And I think that's a really interesting question. And to me, the answer is being fully there with what is difficult and what is not difficult, but that we have this conditioning when things are difficult to pull back. And what is the great paradox, and yet is so simple about spiritual practice, is that the way to freedom is to lean into suffering rather than try to run away from it. That any place where you or I are suffering, there is a perfect pointing at here's what you need to look at to be free. Mm-hmm. And that yet each of us have created a personality structure that's perfectly designed to not feel our fear of death.
Right. Right. Yeah. So and I know before I got to this point where I am today, when dying would pop into my mind, I would get out of that thought as fast as I could. I would flee to another thought so I didn't have to sit with that one. And now that I've gotten to this point where, like the lady Travis that I read about, I mean, I'm looking forward to the experience, right? And my kids don't like me talking about that as well either. But I think it's going to be cool and exciting because I can't wait to see what's beyond. So, such a just, I have so much freedom around this now that shapes other parts of me, my life, my personality, and what I do in life that is just empowering folks. So I really invite you to study Dale's work, go to his website, and look at your death. You're going to die, and there's no ands, ifs, or buts about that. But what happens after you die? And the other thing that causes me to do is really evaluate my life on a daily basis. What am I doing? Am I wasting my time? Am I wasting my money? What could I do better? You know. So I just love what you do, and you've been such a great inspiration to me and to a help. Now, you also talk about a practice of Tonglen. Can you tell the audience what that's about?
Well, it's a wonderful practice to cultivate more deeply love and compassion. And as I mentioned before, we're really conditioned to try to get away from suffering. Tonglen, as it's traditionally taught in Asia, is, and it's spelled T-O-N-G-L-E-N. There's a couple of descriptions of it on our website. If you want to take a look, it's a practice that Pema Chodron, a famous Buddhist teacher, talks a lot about. But it's traditionally taught, you do it for another person who's suffering. But in the West, we often need to do it for ourselves. In the East, it's assumed, well, if you're a meditator, you're not suffering, so you help other people. The Dalai Lama, on his third visit to America, said, "Now I'm beginning to understand, and it makes me very sad, you Americans don't like yourselves."
Right, self-love.
So in Asia, it's assumed that you like yourself, and we can begin this big project of disidentifying with ego structure and identifying with true nature, with Christ consciousness, with Buddha nature. So the Tonglen is a technique, it's a practice that is a little complicated to describe here in the next few minutes, but I'll just give a summary of it. In which you cultivate love and compassion for a quality of suffering in you or in somebody else or in a group of people. So let's just assume, for ease of talking about it, that you've identified a place in you that's getting caught again and again, that's causing you suffering. So you visualize this part of you in front of you. There's meditating you, and in front of you is suffering you. And the first thing you do is you open your heart. The nature of the open heart is a spacious heart, a warm heart, a connected heart. Maybe you breathe the sky into your heart, or you remember a time when your heart was really warm and open. And then the next step, the second step, the most difficult step, is you feel the suffering that you imagine this other person is feeling. Because in this case that we're talking about, it's yourself. You have to go in there and feel what it's like. Not just you're thinking about it or you're imagining, but what does it really feel like? Mm-hmm. And you let this feeling deepen enough until compassion begins to arise in you. A wish, compassion is the same as loving kindness,
right?
But it's in the context where there is suffering. So you're opening your heart to the suffering that suffering you is feeling.
Yeah. Why do, and I think you're right. You'll know better. Go ahead.
I'm not quite done yet.
Go ahead.
So you open your heart to the suffering. You start to feel compassion for it. You deepen the compassion to the point where you become willing to take the suffering into you. Mm-hmm. And as you breathe in, you take the suffering, visualizing that it's coming into your heart of hearts. And as you breathe out, you send the antidote with loving kindness, focusing on the feeling of compassion as you breathe in and loving kindness as you breathe out. So that you're doing something here that's kind of the opposite of what we usually do, and that is taking in the good stuff and pushing away the bad stuff. Here, through the force of compassion, we're willing to take in that which is most difficult for somebody else or part of ourselves, and give our own love that which is most precious.
And it's a beautiful way to us to get out of anxiety or suffering, right? And to move past that moment and bring
Definitely.
Healing to it. Yeah.
Yes.
So Dale, you have the benefit of the Eastern philosophy and the Western. You studied both. Why is it that the Western people are so hate themselves? Or so, you know, we have this, the critic up here and the judge, and it's like a constant struggle, and we're always beating ourselves up. Where does that come from?
Well, first of all, the East is changing a lot too. I mean,
it's becoming westernized.
Yeah, it is.
Unfortunately.
Well, I mean, a lot of it has to do with the fact that these Eastern practices were developed by and for people who were walking around barefoot. They loved their mother and their father. They slept in a bed with their parents when they were kids. Had an intact nuclear family. Right. I remember once I was at a Tibetan Buddhist day-long meditation thing, and the Lama said, "Okay, we're going to do a heart practice now. So everybody think about your mother so you can open your hearts." He said, "Oh, wait a minute. We're in America. I forgot. Mm. Think about your mother might not open your heart."
Yeah.
Which was a really sad thing. So that And I want to say very clearly that I am not romanticizing the East. That they had their own problems.
Right, right.
A certain lack of initiative or something like that. And we have the initiative, we're more independent, but right. There's a kind of an egoic caughtness in all of that.
Let me ask you this, because you're in your 70s now and I'm in my 60s. And so you've lived a long time and you've seen a lot of things. And how do you see the world today from where it was when you were younger? And where do you see it headed? And any thoughts of what we can do to make it better?
Well, I've got a teenage son and I look at the world and I mean, I'm just reading a book now about how artificial intelligence is going to put so many millions of people out of work.
Wow.
And people are going to be displaced. At the same time, I really think the younger generation, when I look at my son, he's so much more awake and present than I was at his age. And I really think that there are young people who are going to change the world. I'm not really pessimistic about it, but I think a lot of people are going to be crushed in the gears of the machine as we move forward. So I work with dying people. I work with them often one at a time or in small groups and working with healers or healthcare practitioners. At the same time, fear of death is collective. Mm-hmm. It's cultural. And one of the best things that we could do is work with that fear in ourselves and wake up. I mean, I remember when George Bush was president, I thought you could put me in a room with him, George Bush the younger, and I could give him all my wisdom and my teachings, and it wouldn't probably change him one inch. But if he found out that his daughter had breast cancer or his wife was dying and you put me in the room with him, then maybe
right.
he cracked open enough that we could begin to really have a meaningful, transformative discussion.
Yeah.
And so we live in a death-denying society, and that you can donate to Oxfam or Amnesty International or Habitat for Humanity or the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or whatever you like. But as long as there's this underlying fear of death, you put a bandage over the wound over here and then the blood starts spurting out over there and you run over here and you put the bandage over there. And it's because as long as people have this unconscious fear of death, they're going to be driven by greed and selfishness because there's not enough. I'm going to die. I need to take care of myself. I need to take care of my kids in a way that's based in poverty and fear.
Yeah.
Rather than this, in a sense of wholeness and generosity.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, we're almost out of time here. And this is a big subject. I know a lot of people are going to, you know, flee from it and not want to think about it. But I encourage you to have the courage to go inside and really think about your own death and what you can do to lose that fear. And I think if you follow Dale's work and go to his website, you'll find a lot of powerful information that will help you. Another thing is, if there's someone close to you that's approaching death or has been told they're going to die soon, reach out to Dale's organization. And if you're in the Bay Area, you can have a volunteer, or perhaps they can help you via Skype or Zoom. And you'll be blessed by the work that they do when they come in to have someone that's been there to assist you in this process while you're going through all this fear and sadness. It's great to have someone totally awake and conscious that can help you guide your loved one to the other side. And it's been such a blessing for me to learn this skill and then be able to apply it for those that are in need. And it's just a huge blessing. The other thing is, the Living Dying Project is all, it's a 501c3 nonprofit foundation. So it works on the donations of others. So if you feel led to support this work, I encourage you to go to the website, donate some money, check it out. The more you give, the more you're blessed. Dale, before we go, anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I really am grateful that you're my friend. I think your radio show is helping a lot of people. I really encourage all of your enthusiasm and your getting out in the world and shaking the trees and getting people to pay attention and to create a life that works. I've got a friend right now who's really sick, and she just has a lot of negative thoughts about how her life has been a failure and how it's been so difficult for her to find any positivity. And it's really hard to do the work that we're talking about here.
Right.
When it's the end of your life and there's medications in your bloodstream and there's all these confusing things going on. Now's the time to start waking up.
Yeah.
Don't wait till the doctor says, I got really bad news for you.
Amen, my brother. Thank you for being my friend, Dale. Thank you for being there and supporting my wife as she passed over. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a great show next Thursday for you. We're going to bring in a great publisher and another author and teach you how to write a book if you want and how to get it published if you want to. In the meantime, go out there and make this the best day of your life.
You've been listening to Mike Murphy, unfiltered, unfettered, unflinching, unafraid, on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Thanks for tuning in, and don't miss the next unfiltered show next Thursday from noon to 2 Pacific Time on TransformationTalkRadio.com, as Mike Murphy and a cast of powerful guests strip away the veil of limitation using the groundbreaking practices of the creation frequency. Tune in to unleash the power of your mind. Open the immense energy of the heart to manifest an awesome life filled with true health, wealth, confidence, gratitude, and joy. Unfiltered truth, unfiltered frequency, unfiltered possibilities on Mike Murphy Unfiltered Radio. For more information on Mike and his work, visit MikeMurphyUnfiltered.com.